Hi, everybody. There may be Barbie. I'm going to, like, full disclosure, I have totally failed to plan out this talk in full detail because the week kind of got away from me, and I have no cool slides like literally every other speaker I've seen here, which is testament to my utter lack of technological knowledge that all of you have because you're here at AMF camp. So I'm just going to do my best anyway. But this is basically, I'm kind of talking from a book I wrote called Women vs. Hollywood, which is an attempt to distill about 125 years of film history into a quite small book and try and explain why it is that women are a minority in the film business, because it wasn't always this way. When film started off, the very first cinema, you know, projection ever in history, I think many of you probably know this if you're film fans, 1895, the Lumiere brothers, an arrival of a train at the Gare de la Ciotat in the south of France, and it's literally a 30-second clip of a train coming into a station, a bunch of people getting off. So that was December 1895 that was first broadcast to the public. About 3 months later, a woman called Alice Guy, who was a secretary for Léon Gaumont, who was the head of one of the kind of nascent film companies, asked to borrow her boss's camera, and she shot what we think is the first ever narrative film. It's the first ever piece of fiction put on to a moving image. It was called The Cabbage Fairy, and it's basically this like little ridiculous frippery, to be honest, about a fairy going into a cabbage patch and harvesting a baby and giving it to a couple. And that's where babies come from, people. So you never say you don't learn anything at EMF camp. This was, as far as anyone can tell, the very, very first narrative film. And Alice Guy continued to borrow her boss's camera and continued then to work for Gaumont, and she actually became the company's head of production. So this is in the 1890s. You have this young woman who made, by some accounts, over 1,000 films, demonstrating what the company could do. And Gaumont was a technology company, so she was essentially doing what John Lasseter would do for Pixar in the early 1980s. She was making stories that would show off what the company's technology could do. So she was playing with sound in the 1890s. She was playing with color in the 1890s. She was making movies for Gaumont. And as time went on, she became more and more ambitious. So from those 30-second movies that they began with, which was standard for the time, she wasn't slacking, she got up to like a butt-numbing 35 minutes for her epic, The Life of Christ. I mean, I know, nightmare. So she became a really, really important figure in world history and in cinema history. And when the time came to write the history of Gaumont Studios, she was left out. Completely. Now, after she left Gaumont, she got married in about, I think it was 1907. She moved to the States. She set up her own studio called Solax. She continued to make movies. By that point, she'd married a cameraman, Herbert Blachet. She was known as Alice Guy Blachet. And in her studio in Solax, she made, again, hundreds more films. She innovated. She had Be Natural written in large letters on the studio wall and produced really quite effective little films, often with children. She was very good at getting naturalistic performances out of kids, like Steven Spielberg, but, you know, 80 years earlier. All was well until in 1917 or so, Herbert left her. He moved to Hollywood. And a couple of years later, she was hit by the Spanish flu. And the two of those blows basically made her career fall apart. Now, the problem with Herbert leaving was not that he was the power behind the throne. It wasn't that he was the real filmmaking genius here. The problem with Herbert leaving is he is the person that the financiers would talk to. And so when he left, it suddenly became very, very hard for her to get money for her films. And by 1917, films were getting longer. They were up to, please steady yourself, 2 reels or more. Crazy length. And it was becoming more and more expensive to make films as a result. So that kind of cottage industry model that she had worked under at Solax was becoming more and more difficult. Elsewhere in the Silent Era, you've got someone like Lois Weber. Now, Lois started off as an actress. She actually worked for Alice Guy Blachet in one of her Solax films. And then she and her husband set themselves up as independent filmmakers. They were very successful. They were headhunted by Universal Studios in its very early days, brought to Hollywood. There, in Hollywood, in the mid-1910s, Lois Weber was the second highest paid director in town. Not the second highest paid female director, the second highest paid director in all of Hollywood in 1917. She was considered like the gold standard. She was actually elected mayor of Universal. Kind of. There was a whole thing with the elections and somebody else won, and then they decided for public relations they would have the woman winning because wasn't that daring and crazy at a time when women didn't have the vote. But nevertheless, she was appointed, let's say, mayor of Universal, and she was a major, major proponent of the art of cinema, the art of directing, the importance of a director. She was a massive ambassador for cinema generally. She talked incessantly about how important cinema was, how much scope there was for film to change the world for the better, for film to be educational, for film to improve people, for film to, you know, make the world a more moral place. It was very Victorian in attitude, but she was kind of coming from a good place. And like I say, she was massively lauded in her time. One of the trade papers at the time said she's considered one of the greatest female directors in Hollywood, and some people say you should remove the modifier female. She's just one of the greats. She used montage, she used split screen very early in a suspense film called Suspense. They didn't have great naming categories in those days. And she was a major, major talent. And yet, only about 4 years later, by 1921, her career was, to all intents and purposes, completely over. So what the heck happened? Because in that silent era, in that sort of mid-teens period in Hollywood, 50% of screenwriters, by some estimates, were female. There's an organization called the Women Film Pioneers Project that has been assembling information and you know, accounts and bios of all the women working in Hollywood at that time, and working in film worldwide, in fact, at that time, and what they did. And they have found literally hundreds of women doing jobs that either were described as director at the time or would be so described now, because the roles hadn't been 100% codified, so you might not take a quote-unquote director credit even though you did that work. But they find hundreds and hundreds of these women working in film. So basically, what the heck happened? Why do we get to a stage where now, in a good year, maybe 12% of directors are female? It's not much better for screenwriters. It's much worse for composers and cinematographers. So what's going on? So basically, that's what I've tried to kind of work my way through in the book. Now, the big catastrophic change really did come in the 1910s. So no sooner was cinema established as a major art form than women started being pushed out of it. It wasn't the arrival of the talkies, it wasn't the setup of the formal kind of studio system, but it kind of was. What happened was that the films got longer and the films got more expensive. And it got to the point where if you wanted to make films regularly, you were going to have to borrow money from banks. And of course, in those days, up until horrifyingly recently, women couldn't borrow money in their own name. Banks wouldn't necessarily give them credit. So if you were part of a married couple and you really trusted your husband, then okay, maybe he could borrow the money and you guys could work together and you could have a career. But, you know, beyond a certain point, no. Both Lois Weber and Alice Guy Blaché, their marriages fell apart and so did their career. But also, the wider situation was changing. As films got north of an hour and got up to, you know, their current sort of 90 to 120 minute average length, you got to a point where only major studios could make them. You got to a point where you needed the big bankers in New York to be sending regular large checks over to get the films made. And those men, all men, would not deal with women, essentially. So what you began to see was these people who had hits. It wasn't that they were unpopular. It wasn't that they weren't doing a good job. It wasn't that they were getting bad reviews. They just couldn't get the money because they didn't look like the right kind of person. Now, let me just be clear at this point. These women I'm talking about were white, straight, cis, able-bodied women. It was much worse for anybody who didn't meet all of those criteria. I'm not saying that they had it hardest or anything. What I am saying is that even with all those advantages on their side, they still couldn't get past this need for money. And honestly, a lot of that still remains. If you think, I don't know if any of you guys have seen Babylon, absolutely freaking terrible film, don't get me started, but if you've seen any of these films from, you know, set in the 1910s, set in the 1920s, about Hollywood, about filmmaking, they had already begun to establish this image of what a director looked like. And what a director looked like was Cecil B. DeMille in Riding Crops with a whip. And what a director looked like was, you know, a big patrician man, basically. D.W. Griffith, who made the fantastically racist films that were major hits in 1915. That image took hold. That's what a director looked like. And so if you came in as someone like Lois Weber, who was, you know, matronly, you know, quite staid, deliberately quite sort of safe looking, it didn't seem safe anymore. That's not what they expected a person wielding authority to look like. So that's what began to kind of fall away. All of these women, not just Lois and Alice, but they're the ones who kind of left most trace behind. But like Alice talked about the fact that by the time she was finishing her career as the head of production at Gaumont, she literally had crews sabotaging her work. At one point, one of her sets was burned the day before it was supposed to be used because the crew no longer wanted to work for a woman. Lois Weber talked about the same thing, having praised the crews at Universal early in her career and said how willing they were to work all together, all as a team, under her authority. By the end of her career, she said they were no longer willing to do that. And I think it's about that pernicious creep of kind of professionalism. So this has happened in other industries. If you think about whiskey, or if you think about wool, both of those were industries dominated by women when they were cottage industries. When they became capital I capitalist industries, then suddenly the women were forced out and it was men who took over. And the same thing happened in cinema, and quite frankly, the same thing would happen in coding in the 60s as well. Women weren't allowed to exercise authority. And I don't know if to be fair to the men is the right way to put this, but maybe to be fair to the men, this was a time when women didn't even have the vote. So it must have felt weird to, you know, a cinematographer in 1917 to be working for a woman. This isn't even a full citizen. So how is she bossing me around and what does that say about me? So I think there was this problem that as cinema became professionalized, there no longer seemed to be a place for female directors. Female screenwriters survived in smaller numbers, most of them in the studio era, which ran from the 20s until the late 40s, although it's kind of still with us. Most of them, the female scriptwriters who remained, were part of a husband-wife writing couple. They were not solo female scriptwriters. There were a few into the 30s who had survived from the silent era. Frances Marion is a very famous, very successful one. She won a couple of Oscars. Generally speaking, most of the female screenwriters were working with their husband or not working at all. They were forced into other industries. So you had this weird closing of the gates. After everything seemed open in this new, exciting industry that had never existed before, all the possibilities seemed endless, there was just this closing down, this shutting down. Very quickly, just to address the studio system, what the studio system then did was to industrialize movie making. So in the kind of heyday, that 20s to 40s period, what you had was directors, screenwriters, actors, everybody under contract to the studios, and the studios churning out content, as we would now call it, which we never should, to keep them all occupied. So, you know, you would have Greta Garbo under contract for 5 years and you would do your damn best to fill her schedule with as many films as possible and just keep her going from one to the next the whole way through. Same with screenwriters, same with directors, just keep them all working, and that's the studio system, that's the kind of industrial system. Now, of course, treating human beings like they are commodities doesn't always work. People get sick, people get, you know, tired, people have babies. All these problems come up for the poor, poor studios who are just trying to make an enormous sum of money, my God. So there were issues with that. You got female stars being ordered to have abortions. Obviously, that was illegal at the time in the US, but that happened anyway. Lana Turner was forced into having an abortion, basically at the threat of losing her entire livelihood. In a hotel room, nearly lost her life as a result. Gloria Swanson was also very, very seriously ill after an illegal abortion in Paris. Judy Garland was told to have one because people saw her as this young ingenue. They were not ready for her to have a baby. She was married, by the way. This wasn't like it was outside of wedlock. She was literally married at 19, and she was still ordered to have an abortion or lose her studio contract and all her livelihood. You had these horrific, horrific stories of women's lives being entirely shaped by this studio contract. Men too, I mean, look, men were ordered around too, but that particular wrinkle didn't really affect their careers. Tyrone Power, by the way, was responsible for two of the abortions I just mentioned. Didn't matter, he wasn't involved. So you've got these really weird, twisted incentives, I guess, for women working in Hollywood. And it was a very, very difficult time. You also, of course, had the casting couch, which was overwhelmingly something that women faced and not men. We've all heard a lot about that in the last few years with the Me Too movement. You know, the problem with the casting couch is it is, of course, an abuse of power issue. Now, you can be as sex positive as you want. Joan Crawford swore by the casting couch. She said it had given her her start in life and she had no regrets. Fair play to her, right? That's what she wants. The point is not that she would have been doing anything wrong by using the casting couch to get ahead. The point is the studio executive who gave her that choice is abusing their power. That's the issue. So whatever you think about her choices, it doesn't matter what your morality is, whatever you think about her choices, he's abusing his power. Even the porn industry doesn't allow the casting couch. And if you're doing worse than the porn industry, I don't know, maybe take a look at yourself, right? It just seems bad to me. So that was a problem. Another problem was, of course, something we still face in Hollywood today, pay inequality. That was introduced or codified during the studio system. So you had things like Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland were paired together in a series of very successful kind of romantic adventures, right? They had plucked her as an ingenue, essentially from the stage, put her on screen, much against her own better judgment, I think. She signed that first contract not being quite sure that she wanted to act, actually. But anyway, she went into it. She found instant success in this pairing with Errol Flynn. He was given a massive pay rise. She remained on £500 a week. Now, that was extremely good money at the time. I'm not saying, oh my God, she couldn't pay her food or anything, but it is a fundamentally unequal situation. And it was something that then, you know, rolled on and rolled on through your career, meant that women's pay began to separate from their male peers. This is something that still happens. So women going into Hollywood struggle to get roles consistently and keep working at the same rate as their male peers. They are also probably underpaid in those initial roles because they're probably playing a fairly thin, fairly small girlfriend role, while he's more likely to have a major role in the film, historically, right? And that means that sets the benchmark for everything she's paid after that. And if she's not getting an uplift with every subsequent role, and again, not as many female leading roles as there are for men, then those pay gaps begin to open and open and open and open. So that over the course of their career, and we're talking like big stars here, will be paid millions less than their equivalent male peers. And there are now, you know, sort of direct comparisons, partly thanks to the Sony leak, which very famously, for example, announced that Jennifer Lawrence had been paid less than any of the men in, not Silver Linings Playbook, but the other one. It's gone out of my head. Anyway, see, lack of preparation. Passengers was the, after that, it was the other David O. Russell film that she did in the 70s with the microwave. That one, yeah. Anyway. What did you say? American Hustle, thank you so much. Yes, so American Hustle, she was paid less than Jeremy Renner, who was in a supporting role, when she was in a leading role. And this came out in the Sony hack, and she didn't even know this. And that's why Sony paid her more than her male co-star for Passengers, essentially as a, sorry, you caught us. And they shouldn't have, because it was a really bad film, and they shouldn't have made it anyway. But all of these things go back to, you know, this codification in the studio era. Another thing, by the way, that the studio era did is that it codified a lot of racist and homophobic tropes. So during the studio era, they were terrified of being subject to censorship laws, right? They were terrified that Congress was literally going to legislate to control the film industry. Because in 1915, a court case at the Supreme Court had decided that film was not art and therefore was not subject to free speech protection. And therefore, this was a real risk into about the 50s that film could at any moment be completely sort of censored. So instead, they set up this self-censorship system which reflected all the worst instincts of the time. So you could not have an interracial relationship. If you had, you know, and there were films like, there were films which had, like Pinky, which had a black woman and a white man dating, they couldn't touch. And if you wanted to have them touch on film, or if you wanted to have them kiss on film, then they both had to be played by white actors. You got things like the adaptation of A Quiet Earth, wasn't it? Where Anna May Wong, the great Asian actress of the 1920s, was not considered for the lead role of a Chinese woman because she was Chinese and they'd already cast a white man as the Chinese man in the film. So they couldn't have an interracial relationship, so she was shit out of luck, excuse my language. So you had all of this kind of racially codified laws set in place. You also, of course, I mean, at the time, it will not surprise you to know, they were not telling a lot of gay stories. And if they were telling gay stories, they were really pulling their punches, and it all ended very tragically. So you had to get into basically the 50s before you started having any gay topics being dealt with at all, and then they were almost always tragic. Almost always, I mean, like overwhelmingly so. The bury your gaze trope we have today is a mere shadow of what it was in the 50s and 60s and 70s. So all of these attitudes got kind of baked into what we expect of Hollywood. And essentially we learned to expect that straight, cis, white, able-bodied men would lead films, because that's what kept happening over and over and over again. And you kind of have to wonder, like, what it says about us as a civilization, as a culture, if all of our heroes on screen, or an overwhelming majority of them at least, are straight, cis, white, able-bodied men. It's not really representative to have this one minority ruling over all the others, you know, but it is something that Hollywood has really codified and baked in throughout its history. And with all due respect, you know, hashtag some, not all men, some of my best friends are straight, cis, white, able-bodied men. My fiance's one. But at the same time, it's, you know, it is a minority group, and we don't treat it as such. We treat that as the human default setting, and everyone else is a special interest. And, you know, maybe not to all our benefits, not even to men's benefits, I would argue. I don't think it helps. So you had all of this going through. You also then got into, once you got out of the worst of the studio era, and I'm going to really rattle through a couple of things now, they started to think about this idea of whether films could be art. So in the 50s, the Miracle case decided, the Supreme Court again, decided, no, we were wrong in 1915, we're right now, films are evidently art and are worthy of our protection as free speech, okay? But then the question became, who is the artist? Because a whole lot of people make a film. It's not like, you know, painting a picture, most pictures. It's a lot of people. So who is the artist? Well, of course, the answer that they came up with, naturally born out of France, because, you know, who else is going to theorize about these things while smoking a Gauloise, was the auteur theory, right, as it's popularly described. So this is the idea that some directors, at least, have a clear voice, a clear vision, and it is that shapes the film that is made, right? They are the artist. Now, this is an important and a useful idea in many ways, because it did lead to film preservation being taken seriously. It led to film criticism and film theory being taken seriously, and those are all really good things. But also, it raises the question of who we consider an auteur. Because again, and it's not going to surprise you, overwhelmingly, the people that we describe as auteurs are the straight, mostly straight, white men. And that does become a bit of a problem. Like, even the people who were coming up with this theory weren't including, you know, Agnes Varda, who was working at the time. They couldn't include Alice Guy, because one of the tenets of the French theory about all of this was that you had to consider a director's entire body of work to decide if he was an auteur or not. And of course, loads of her films had been lost. So, I mean, she might have been. Boof, you know. So again, you get into this thing where you have control of who's considered to be a director, who's allowed to be the artist on a film. And also you get directors leaning into this. Again, not all directors, respect to some we have in here. But some directors really lean into this idea of themselves as the artist, as the powerful person on set. You get cases of the Svengali, the director who tries to create his leading ladies and who then tries to take credit for anything they do. You know, people like Otto Preminger, maybe. People like Howard Hawks, actually, with Lauren Bacall, for example. You get these directors who want to shape stars into the image of their ideal woman and then take credit for everything they do. You also get what I personally tend to describe as method directing, which is when you get some directors who try to essentially abuse a performance out of their cast members. And this is not this does not only happen to women, but it tends to happen more to women. So if you ever read about Kim Basinger on the set of 9 1/2 Weeks, basically, her director thought she couldn't act well enough to give the performance he wanted, so he basically tried to torment it out of her. So you get into those kind of issues. Also, one of the forces we have shaping cinema nowadays, this has kind of come up a little bit later, is the question of intellectual property, right? So right now, films are not so much led by movie stars. If you think back to the 90s, let's say, it would be like, oh my gosh, you know, Julia Roberts is starring in a new film. And now it's like, oh my gosh, they're adapting Sherlock Holmes again. So they've leaned away from personalities and they've leaned into ideas, because ideas cannot get drunk at 3 o'clock in the morning and appear in the Daily Mail the next day, right? Captain America won't fall out of a pub drunk. The possibility exists that Chris Evans might, you know? So they lean into these ideas because it takes that human issue, that messy humanness, out of the equation a little bit. You don't have to build a franchise around a star anymore. You don't have to rely on them not aging, not getting pregnant, not being difficult to work with, wanting more money. You can build build the series around the idea, and then you can just keep recasting with younger, cheaper people until the cows come home. And that's what we're seeing now. Now, the problem with this, I mean, well, there's a lot of problems with this, and I say that as somebody who loves the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but one of the major problems with this is that a lot of these established ideas that they're leaning into because they think it will keep their money safe, these are ideas that have been established at least 30, 40 years ago, or even longer. So you have something like, you know, they're remaking The Terminator, they're remaking Superman, they're remaking Tarzan, they're remaking Sherlock Holmes. These are characters who were created at least decades ago, if not a century or more, and it changes who's able to play them, because we've seen what happens when you try to race bend or gender bend some of these fan favorites. It goes very, very badly wrong for the people who are playing them. So all of these forces essentially end up with a cinema that is still dominated by the same people, with a cinema where male directors are still given many more opportunities than women, where women are still, as I say, in a good year, 12% of directors, just over 12% of leads now in films, still over 80% male leads in films, most of those white, most of those straight, almost all of those able-bodied. We still have an enormously long way to go to get back to the kind of openness that Hollywood had before it was Hollywood, to get back to the openness of the silent era. And with the cost of filmmaking going up and up and up and up, it doesn't seem like that's stopping anytime soon. So anyway, I do see hope for the future. I'm going to wrap it up. I do see hope for the future. Things like the Me Too movement, things like the Time's Up movement that have highlighted the sexual abuse problems, that have highlighted the pay gap. All the talk we have now about female directors since the massive success of things like Barbie, hey, and Wonder Woman showed that hiring a woman to tell a woman's story can pay off really big time. that's beginning to change things, but it's happening really slowly because there are all of these different forces at work that are just trying to keep the status quo, not even consciously. They're just, that's just what they think film is. And I think it's up to all of us, if we get the chance to see a film made by underrepresented groups, starring, you know, underrepresented groups, that we try a little bit extra hard to give those films a chance, give those films our support, and hope that that moves things forward. Anyway, I will be at the Q&A tent, but thank you very much, and I hope I didn't waffle too much. Thanks.